A guilty plea in the Charlottesville white supremacist killings, a lawsuit filed in California accusing Trump of deporting asylum seekers, and a traffic expert, the voice you hear every day on your subway ride.
The next, Downtown, number 2, will arrive in 3 minutes. Please stand away from the platform edge.
With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Wednesday, March 27, 2019. First to Jennifer Hodge with these headlines.
Education Secretary Betsy DeVos wants to eliminate funding to the Special Olympics. DeVos said the organization raises $100 million on its own every year. And while DeVos says she is supporting IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, she says she wants to make cuts to other programs which will help students with disabilities, such as special education. Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan grilled DeVos at an education hearing on Capitol Hill.
I want to follow up on the thing Ms. Lee mentioned about the cuts to Special Olympics. Do you know how many kids are going to be affected by that cut, Madam Secretary?
Mr. Pocan, let me just say again, we had to make some difficult decisions with this budget.
Again, this is a question on how many kids, not about
the
budget.
I don't know the number of kids.
It's 272,000 kids. I'll answer it for you. That's okay. No problem. It's 272,000 kids that are affected.
Special Olympics is an awesome organization, one that is well supported by the philanthropic sector as well.
Sure. I'll tell you, reclaiming my time if I could, Madam Secretary, because there's a couple more parts to this. So also, we have cuts that go in the special education grants to states from $3 million to $2.2 million, a 26% cut. And then also in this budget, you have a $7.5 million cut to the National Technical Institute for the Blind, a $13 million cut for Gallaudet University, a $5 million cut for federal program for print books for blind students. And you recently had a federal judge rule against us on some areas around special education. I have two nephews with autism. What is it that we have a problem with children who are in special education? Why are we cutting all of these programs over and over within this budget?
Well, sir, we have continued to retain the funding levels for IDEA and held that level. So in the context
IDEA. I believe I brought up Special Olympics, special education grants to states, the National Technical Institute for the Blind, Gallaudet University, federal program for printing books. So if you could address those. That's the question
but
I would really appreciate.
I will address the broader question around.
Or if you could actually address the question I asked, that's even a better way to answer a question.
Supporting students with special needs, we have continued to hold that funding level, that funding at a level amount, and in the context of a budget proposal that is a 10% reduction.
All right, I'll reclaim my time. You're not going to answer the question.
In other news, two New York lawmakers say a proposal for banning plastic shopping bags has gained traction to be included in the next state budget being negotiated in Albany. Senator Todd Kominsky and Assemblyman Steve Englebright, both Long Island Democrats, say they're optimistic that a ban on single-use plastic shopping bags could be included in the spending plan that's due Sunday. They say ongoing discussions on the issue include whether to impose a fee on paper bags. The Democrat-controlled legislature is working to resolve debates over the details of several proposals in Cuomo's $175 billion spending plan, including eliminating cash bail for criminal defendants and a permanent extension of the existing 2% cap on local property tax increases. In other news, a county in New York City's northern suburbs is banning unvaccinated minors from public places to fight a measles outbreak that has infected more than 150 people since October. Rockland County Executive Ed Day declared a state of emergency to persuade parents to have their children vaccinated to reverse the trajectory of the disease's spread.
Anyone who is under 18 years of age and is unvaccinated against the measles will be barred from public places until the declaration expires in 30 days or until they receive at least their first shot of MMR.
The county is experiencing New York State's longest measles outbreak since the disease was officially eliminated from the United States in 2000. Health officials say the best way to stop the disease's spread is a high vaccination rate in the community. A federal judge this month denied a request from parents to let 44 unvaccinated children return to the Waldorf School in Rockland County. The Pittsburgh City Council gave a tentative proposal on Wednesday to gun control legislation introduced in the wake of the 2018 synagogue massacre. The legislation will place restrictions on military-style assault weapons, like the AR-15 rifle that authorities say was used in the October 27th rampage at Tree of Life Synagogue. It killed 11 and wounded 7. It would also ban most uses of armor-piercing ammunition and high-capacity magazines, and would allow the temporary seizure of guns from people who are determined to be a danger to themselves or others. Facebook is extending its ban on hate speech to prohibit the promotion and support of white nationalism and white separatism. Facebook says, "We're announcing a ban on praise, support, and representation of white nationalism and separatism on Facebook and Instagram, which we'll start enforcing next week." The social network says it's clear that these concepts are deeply linked to organized hate groups and have no place on our services. Kristen Clark, executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, says, "This is long overdue as the country continues to deal with the gripe of hate and the increase of violent white supremacy." She says, "We need the tech sector to do its part to combat these efforts."
Thank you very much, Jennifer. A man convicted on state murder charges in a deadly car attack at a white nationalist rally in Virginia has pleaded guilty to federal hate crime charges. James Alex Fields Jr. of Maumee, Ohio, pleaded guilty Wednesday to 29 federal charges stemming from the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville on August 12, 2017. The 21-year-old Fields was convicted in December of first-degree murder and other state charges for killing anti-racism activist Heather Heyer and injuring dozens of others. A jury found that Fields intentionally plowed his car into a crowd of people protesting against the white nationalists. On Wednesday, Fields admitted he violated federal hate crime laws when he targeted the group. And a Brooklyn council member is under heavy Twitter fire after tweeting at a Muslim journalist that Palestine does not exist. The comments were part of a heated Twitter thread between Democratic council member Kalman Yeager, who represents a swath of South Brooklyn, and Zainab Iqbal, a reporter for Brookliner. Now activists and advocates are calling for the politician's removal from the New York City Council Immigration Committee. "You're an anti-Semite and a member of Congress," Yeager tweeted in response to Representative Ilhan Omar's tweet about AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, focus on her at their conference this year. Yeager did not back off. "Palestine does not exist. There, I said it again. Also, Congresswoman Omar is an anti-Semite. Said that, too. Thanks for following me," he responded to Iqbal. Prominent activists also got involved in the conversation. Journalist Sean King responded to Yeager's tweets, "Wow, this is a real tweet from a New York City councilman. It's disgraceful, irresponsible, and dangerous for a sitting New York City council member to engage in blatant bigotry and erasure," Linda Sarsour, a Palestinian-American community organizer from Brooklyn, told the Brooklyn Eagle. "I am Palestinian, I exist, and so does my community. Yeager needs to be removed from the New York City Council Immigration Committee and apologize publicly to Palestinian New Yorkers." And the American Civil Liberties Union, Southern Poverty Law Center, and Center for Gender and Refugee Studies filed a federal lawsuit Friday challenging the Trump administration's new policy forcing asylum seekers to return to Mexico and remain there while their cases are considered. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of 11 individual asylum seekers forcibly returned to Mexico and organizational plaintiffs, Innovation Law Lab, the Central American Resource Center of Northern California, Legal Center of the Race, the University of San Francisco School of Law, Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic, Al Otro Lado, and the Tahrir Justice Center. Blaine Bookie is co-legal director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Rights, one of the key plaintiffs in the action. The center is representing a lesbian woman who fears reprisal in Mexico. Bookie says the suit is combating just the latest attempt to slam America's doors to outsiders.
The United States for decades now has recognized that individuals who are fleeing persecution or torture have the right to seek asylum and other protections here in the United States. And the Trump administration is seeking to keep asylum seekers, forcing them to return to Mexico while they wait for their immigration court proceedings to move forward in the United States. And it's sending people back who have a serious fear of persecution and torture in Mexico, not only in their home countries, but also in Mexico while they're waiting there. And they have lack of access to attorneys and just a real inability to participate meaningfully with the asylum process here in the United States. So this is just the latest in this administration's attempt to slam our doors to asylum seekers.
literally people are coming to the border in large numbers, but not to sneak in, but to present themselves at the border. And the president has talked about that as a crisis.
The government's one of their stated goals in many of the different policies that they've enacted to try to keep asylum seekers out is to deter asylum seekers from sneaking in surreptitiously outside of regular ports of entry. And this policy of forcing asylum seekers to return to Mexico in the initial rollout has been specifically to keep out people who are presenting themselves at a port of entry.
How does that work?
The individual comes to the port of entry and says that they are afraid and that they want to seek asylum. And then the government, you know, identifies certain people as being subject to these so-called migration protection protocols, to this forced return policy, and then literally sends them back to Mexico to wait.
Now, what are these protocols? I mean, what would happen if the system was working the way it should?
The government alleges that it will not send individuals back to Mexico who have a fear of being in Mexico, who have a legitimate fear of being in Mexico. But so far, the standard that they've applied is so incredibly high that it's almost impossible to meet. So procedures are just wholly inadequate and lacking. Even if the government, you know, were keeping people inside the United States that had a fear of being in Mexico, the procedures they have in place now are just totally inadequate for actually recognizing legitimate cases.
So they're basically making it so difficult for you to claim that you have a legitimate claim of persecution in Mexico that no one can meet it.
That's right.
And so what are some of the claims that are being made?
Most of the individuals who are being subjected to this policy are fleeing extreme violence in Central America. And these individuals have a fear in Mexico of being migrants in Mexico. They've been subject to violence, assault, threats by police officers and other authorities in Mexico, as well as by Mexican citizens. There's a lot of hostility towards migrants going through Mexico, and a lot of violence and threats, and there have been murders in Mexico. And then also our clients also have a fear that they'll be deported to their home countries by Mexico. There have been documented many cases of the Mexican government unlawfully deporting people to their home countries. And then finally, the individuals in this lawsuit are also afraid of their persecutors from Central America, that they'll come and find them in Mexico where they have little protection or community support. And these individuals have literally seen their persecutors in Mexico and have seen that they have ties to Mexican gangs and cartels.
What is the history of this legal action and what is it attempting to do?
The complaint is seeking, it's filed saying that this forced return policy violates our immigration laws, it violates the Administrative Procedures Act, and also our international obligations. And we sought a temporary restraining order that was converted into a preliminary injunction, where we were asking the judge to temporarily halt this policy and halt its expansion while the judge makes a final determination on whether this policy is lawful. And so that's all we're asking at this stage, is for the judge to temporarily stop the government from being able to apply this policy and to expand it at other areas in the southern border until there's been a full hearing on the issues.
When do you expect a decision?
We expect a decision soon. The judge, you know, definitely seems like he understood the real dangers that these individuals are facing in Mexico. And if he is going to take any action, we hope that he would do so soon, in recognition that the harms that could befall our plaintiffs are imminent. We're very hopeful that the judge will take some action, given how patently unlawful and cruel this policy is.
Blaine Bookie is co-legal director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Rights, one of the key plaintiffs in the legal action. And a coalition of local groups are gathering at noon on Friday, March 29th in Yonkers near the Riverfront Library to urge New York State Senator and Majority Leader Andrea Stewart Cousins to support three bills written to advance social justice in New York State. The change in Albany means the traditional three men in a room that approves legislation has been replaced by two men and a woman. But sociologist Kathy Kaufman of the Westchester Coalition for Police Reform says even progressive legislators need to prioritize social justice laws.
We're calling it a flash demonstration. So we're convening a coalition of people from organizations all over Westchester County to send a message to Senator Andrea Stewart Cousins, asking her to prioritize social justice, economic justice, and racial justice in the bills that are currently being considered for funding in the budget in Albany.
Specifically, what are those bills?
There are three issues in particular that we'd like for her to focus on, and we know that she has not strongly supported any of them. So, but they're critical to constituents in Westchester County and across the state. So those are marijuana justice, which is legalization of marijuana to try to stem the tide of arrests and criminalization that happens because people are in possession of small amounts of marijuana. The second one is bail reform, so that New Yorkers of low income or limited income don't end up incarcerated for prolonged periods of time because they can't make bail, even though they have not been convicted of a crime. And the third one is something called Project Greenlight, which is regulation that would allow immigrants, regardless of their immigration status, to get driver's licenses, which would allow them, which would increase public safety because it means that everyone has to take a driver's test and people would be, learning to drive in a more regulated way. If you are an undocumented immigrant, you're not going to pursue a driver's license because you're not eligible for one. So that means you're actually driving unlicensed. So what that means is that there's this element of unregulated driving that goes on across the state wherever people can't get access to a driver's license. So we want everybody to be driving safely.
Why is there a need for a protest?
Because right now we're at the point where the budget's being negotiated. And that's sort of what used to be called the three men in a room stage of negotiations. And now it's a woman and two men in a room. As the majority leader in the Senate, Stuart Cousins is one of those people. She has not strongly supported any of these measures being included in the budget. And what that means is that they're going to face headwinds when they have to be potentially legislated outside the budget in the spring negotiation process. She's just not really invested political capital in most of these social justice issues.
Is that surprising?
It is, in the sense that I see her as a real champion. And I think that what it probably means is that she and other legislators are exercising political caution, but the ramification is that constituents that are vulnerable, that are really impacted on a daily basis by these three forms of dysfunction, which are being, asked to pay money bail, being not being able to get a driver's license, and potentially being picked up for low-level marijuana possession, which is low-income and people of color very, very hard in Westchester County. All those constituents are basically being thrown to the wayside to smooth the passage of Governor Cuomo's other budget priorities. And that's really a shame. Those are constituents that are the most disempowered in our state. In Westchester County, which is Senator Stuart Cousins' home turf, we like to think of the county as sort of a series of Mayberries, a patchwork quilt of Mayberries. But in reality, we have some of the highest arrest rates for low-level marijuana possession in the state. Black people are 15 times more likely than white people in Westchester County to be picked up on a low-level marijuana possession charge. And Hispanics are 5 times as likely. We have constituents that really need relief now.
And sociologist Kathy Kaufman is from the Westchester Coalition for Police Reform. And in more news from the social justice activist front, Koch Plaza stands in front of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. It is named after David Koch, the billionaire lobbyist. And this is riled activists who are calling out the Met and the Kochs for their role in climate denial. They protested this week in front of the Met. Gabriel Young was there and sends us this report.
Climate change is not a
Activists are outraged that the Koch name appears on the Met, as well as on other buildings in New York City, such as the David Koch Theater at Lincoln Center. That's because of their role in undermining climate science. According to Greenpeace, over the last 2 decades, the Koch Family Foundation spent almost $130 million to directly finance groups that attacked climate change science and policy solutions. And according to Rolling Stone, Koch Industries spent $38 million on lobbying Congress to kill climate legislation. Claire Ullman is with Rise and Resist. She says it's important to build on the momentum from the global student strikes for climate justice.
We want to really insist that this is an intergenerational battle. It's not just the kids, but it's about all of us. We want the world to be safe for our children and grandchildren, too. And we're particularly targeting Koch Plaza today because David Koch and Koch brothers, through their foundations and their industries, have poured millions of dollars into climate denial through underwriting misleading children's books, through campaign contributions, misleading science museum exhibitions. But you can't bribe or persuade the laws of physics with money.
Rise and Resist partnered with 350.org and the Food and Water Watch to co-sponsor the protest at Koch Plaza. Protesters carried signs that said, "Climate Emergency," printed over flames. Others said, "Koch lies, people die," and "Act now or swim later." The activists want to bring attention to forces behind the climate denial and call people to take action. Todd Fernandez with 350.org says the travesty is that big oil influences legislators.
The Koch brothers are one of the major forces behind the oil industry, and they use all their power and all their lobbying power to prevent Congress from taking action. So on that front, one of the biggest demands we have in the climate movement is for all elected officials to take the No Fossil Fuel Money pledge.
Fernandez says the Sunrise Movement, the movement of young people uniting to stop the climate crisis, is working to stop the flow of money from oil lobbyists like the Koch brothers to elected officials. The idea is for people to be free to vote their conscience.
Particularly, we want to draw people's attention to the carbon clock. They're counting the amounts, the parts per million of pollution, essentially is what it is, that's going into the atmosphere. 350.org is named after 350 parts per million. That was supposed to be the limit. We're at 411 now. So there is a countdown, and it's our pollution right now, over the next 20 years, that is going to seal the fate of humanity and the planet forever.
Jamie Bauer says protest is important because it empowers people.
It's important, I think, for people to see people protesting because it makes them think they can do something. But I'm a civil engineer and a transportation planner. So for me, getting rid of fossil fuels and reducing car use and finding alternative means of transportation that don't use fossil fuels are critical.
Ullman with Rise and Resist says there's a lot people can do. She decided to get involved after the 2016 election.
So what you need to do is you need to find out what legislation is being considered where you live. Here in New York, we have the Climate and Community Protection Act that's being considered in Albany this legislative session. Call your state senator, call your assembly member, and demand we have strong climate legislation now. We have to demand that.
Ullman says everybody who works in government works for the people. She says we have to let them know that we care, and that we care a lot. Gabrielle Young, WBAI News, New York.
And finally, in New York City, The Gothamist reports that with exactly 1 month to go until the start of the revised L-Train project, the MTA's leadership is officially reneging on their commitment to allow a third-party monitor to review the scope of the plan and present their findings to the board. There are many potential safety problems, and the governor's plan to finish the job without shutting down the L line has worried some observers. All this might be grist for the transportation mill, but Bernie Wagenblast, who's been a traffic writer and monitor for 40 years, says when New York City does a big transit project, a certain amount of chaos is to be expected.
What is exactly this going to be? What exemptions are there going to be? Are there going to be various loopholes? How much will it be? Are there going to be different times of day where it may not be in effect? All those questions, I think, are the questions that people are asking, and at this point, there's no firm answer. But again, the pressure is on to get this all done by April 1st, so I think that's certainly pushing things, and sometimes when you push things by a deadline, it can backfire on you in terms of unexpected consequences.
Well, is New York facing the traffic apocalypse that they're talking about? Has there been a noticeable increase of car traffic into New York City, or is it just the ability to handle the same amount been degraded?
There certainly has been an increase. You talk about my traffic background. I first started reporting traffic in New York City way back in 1979, and back then, rush hour really didn't even begin until after 6 o'clock in the morning. So now we're looking at rush hours beginning much, much earlier. I think that's certainly pushed things. One of the big things that's changed from back in the 80s and the 90s is all the construction, and that takes away lanes. So you have less capacity when you have things such as that. And certainly another big change from those early days of traffic reporting are the vehicles that are brought onto the streets by companies like Uber and Lyft that certainly weren't there.
They're planning to rip down the and rebuild the BQE. The L train is going to be closing down for 18 months any week now. The federal government is not coming through with a tunnel they were going to build to connect another tunnel to connect New Jersey. People don't want to pay tolls coming into Manhattan on the bridges over the East River, et cetera, et cetera. Is this a chaotic situation, or is this New York business as usual?
New York always has a bit of chaos to it. Anytime you're getting into something political, and certainly anytime you're getting into anything involving transportation, it's such a vast network of highways, roadways, transit systems, so many different agencies that are operating the system. And while the MTA is a state agency, you have a lot of vehicles that are coming into Manhattan from New Jersey, which obviously is another jurisdiction. You have the Port Authority that's involved with that. So there's so many different players. I think just by its very nature, anything involving transportation in New York City is going to have a bit of chaos to it.
And that's some of the news for Wednesday, March 27th, 2019. The news was produced with Jennifer Hodge. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.